Welcome back to the Line Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander, and this is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts on all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's guest is the one and only Mark Sisson. Mark Sisson is a New York Times bestselling author. He is the leading voice, in my perspective, in the longevity conversation. Even though he doesn't really identify with the longevity conversation, he is actually a living embodiment of it. Many of the folks that are popular voices in that space, they're not really that aged. And I'm not that impressed with too many folks in that space, but Mark is truly is a living embodiment of his practices and his principles. He is almost 70 years old. We talk about that quite a bit in the conversation, and he looks tremendous. He has the heart and spirit of a child and the mind and aptitude of a grown-ass man. And I just really enjoy spending time with this guy. He is the founder of Primal Nutrition and Primal Kitchen. He is also the founder of Paluva, which is a shoe company. We talk about that in this conversation as well. Talk about foot health. We talk about longevity. We talk about the mind-body relationship. We get into a lot of really deep, meaningful insights in this conversation. So I think you guys are going to really dig it. I appreciate you guys subscribing so you get each week's episodes. And I also want to invite y'all to check out the Align Podcast YouTube channel, where we post instructional content each week around exercise, movement, mobility, and things of the like. Hope you guys devour this conversation. I'm sure you will. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for doing you. Let's get to it with my guy, Mark Sisson. We're locked.
Cool.
We're loaded. Typically, I do some like new age spiritual breathing practices before we start, but I feel like that's not going to be your vibe, so we're not going to do it.
I appreciate that. Thank you for thinking of me.
Dude, I really look up to you. I think that's very common, but you're about exactly double my age. You've been in a relationship with your wife for 35 years.
Yes.
You're exuberant. You're vital. You're kind. You're comical. You're lighthearted. And you're god dang almost 70 years old.
That's crazy to me, because I feel like I'm in my late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes, you know, facing that mortality is a little bit of a slap in the face. And it manifests itself for me mostly in the physical world that I move in, right? So, you know, you're the movement expert, and I know you can relate, but it's simple things like playing with my 3.5-year-old daughter on the lawn and having to get up and get down 15 times in the space of 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the only time that I'm sort of faced with this, like, whoa, it's, you know, I guess the only other time is when I'm playing ultimate frisbee with 20 somethings and I'm trying to sprint down the field to cover some guy who's going for a long bomb.
What do you know now to be true that you didn't believe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? Is there anything that you've drastically changed your mind on that comes to mind?
Almost nothing. I mean, you know, if we got really philosophical, and I'd say I've always been sort of very appreciative of this thing called life and life force, and knowing that one day it will cease to exist bothers a lot of people, and it doesn't bother me. I sort of use that as a grounding point to take every day as a gift and to say, you know, today I'm going to extract the greatest amount of fulfillment and pleasure and fun and whatever I can from every moment, with that understanding that there is a finiteness to life. I look at some of our friends in the biohacking community who are planning on living to 160 or 180. I'm like,
bunch of nerds,
dude. I'm like, why? I, and so that realization that you just sort of mentioned is that it's the finiteness of life that gives it the real meaning. Yeah. You know, if you lived infinitely, if you were immortal, why would you get up in the morning?
Yeah.
What would be the, you know, the reason to be joyful and excited and want to learn, you know, every single day if you knew that it would never end?
So the reason that, so you don't know this, but when I have somewhat of like a very low level qualm with much of the longevity space, because oftentimes I feel there's a little bit of a disconnect of like actually engaging in the joy of life and like sinking your teeth into it. It's kind of more of this like holding scarcity type mindset of like, okay, just restrict the calories, pull back, we'll get to 120.
Not only that, it seems to be putting off realization and present day experience on the bet that one day I'll arrive at this point where I will appreciate it. And so if I sacrifice and suffer and do all these things today, then in 10 years or 20 years, it will pay off. Well, no, the payoff is right now. The payoff is the moment. And the other thing about the, you know, the biohacking movement that sort of is counter to that is this idea that there are shortcuts, mm-hmm. and that if I don't want to do the work, I just want to get the results.
Yeah.
And so whatever you can give me in the way of a pill or a machine that promises to do 90 minutes of cardio in 10 minutes of wrapped cryo bullshit, I'm not buying that stuff.
Yeah.
So we're back to like, live your life in the moment right now and do the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah. What you don't realize, not that it's that big a deal, my perception or opinion, but you're kind of like my North Star in that conversation. When we're talking about longevity and things of the sort, there's very few people in that space, like audible people with microphones, that I see them, and not to like, you know, hate on anybody else or whatever, but it's very few people that I'm like, oh my God, you look 20 years younger than you actually are. Mm. And you're so vital and you're so like silly and fun. And you have like this like lightheartedness to you. Like it's rare, but I'm like, but Mark Sisson.
Yeah.
Like, well, he's doing it. And he doesn't say longevity hardly at all. Like, what's going on there?
No, it's not a word that really plays a role in my vocabulary in general. I mean, my first t-shirt was Live Long, Drop Dead, right? Yeah. That was sort of the MO there. I try to hang out with a younger crowd. I think old people are boring, so I don't hang out with people my age very much. I try to surround myself with that sort of youthful exuberance and that excitement and that drive that so many people who get past retirement age sort of automatically give up and cease to sort of want to explore anymore. And I'm like, no, I'm just getting started, pal.
In the longevity space, what do you feel is missing? Like what would some standout points that would be the most supportive for people to increase their longevity?
I mean, I think a appreciation of the hedonistic part of life in the moment, so that you can have your cake and eat it. You can have your keto cake and eat it too. Because again, I see some people who enter this space with like blinders on and what's the latest book, and I'm going to follow all of Huberman. I'm going to follow all of Attia, all of Galpin. They're great guys. But I tend to not be quite that obsessed with this. I want to live my life. I want every bite of food I eat to taste great. I don't want to ever go hungry. And even though I do intermittent fasting and I don't eat a lot of food, I'm never hungry. So I don't let hunger drive any part of my life. And I don't force myself to be hungry. I don't do workouts anymore that aren't contemplated on some level to be fun. And even if it's a high intensity workout, like one of my favorite workouts is a 60-second rope pull, as hard as you can, as fast as you can, accumulating as many feet as you can. I don't know if you know these rope pull machines, but they're amazing. And it's brutal, but it's only 60 seconds. And then you're done and you walk around for 4 or 5 minutes and do it again. Four of those in a workout, four times 60 seconds, done for the day, on to the next thing. So even something like that, which is considered maybe, you know, painful by some in real time, to me it's like a finite experience. I get it done, I go about my day. I'd rather, you know, I'm not rather, but other times of my workout are I'm stand up paddling, you know, in the ocean with dolphins and hammerhead sharks and manatees, and it's crazy good. And I'm putting on southern rock music on my speaker that's on my board. I'm having a blast out there, right? Or I ride a fat bike in the sand in Miami. And my wife rides one with me, and she has an electric assist, so we can go on a ride together. So a lot of what I'm doing is just is that fun, is that play that is so missing from the sort of what I would say the typical longevity protocol, which is more regimented and more this is what we're doing today and this is what you have to do tomorrow. And I don't know. Anyway, that's just a little piece of the what I've recognized as the longevity part doesn't even matter if you're not enjoying the journey, if you're not enjoying the process.
Yeah, it seems like mindset is invaluable.
Yeah,
in the whole process. And there's been some research, I think it's from Stanford, around asking people in their 30s their perception of aging. What does it mean to age? And the people that had a perception that like, oh, aging is great. It's just like more time to get better at life and looking forward to my 40s and 50s and like, oh, kids and like, oh, like grandkids, like, wow. Those people, it was about, they had about half the incidence of cardiovascular disease by the time that they were in their 60s.
Yeah.
Compared to those that were like, oh, it's a dreadful, terrible thing. I'm going to start to fall apart.
Yeah.
It becomes their reality.
No, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy for a lot of those people.
So how do you maintain that seemingly healthy outlook on life? Like, I'd imagine you have times where you feel pessimistic.
Down. Oh, yeah. I mean, my wife would say I'm a pessimist at heart.
Yeah.
That I, you know, I'm a glass half empty guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's part of a survival mechanism from, I grew up in a small fishing village in Maine. You know, we were poor, but we didn't know it. You know, the whole story that goes behind that. So security was a big deal for me, financial security. And knowing I had a roof over my head and food in my belly was a real thing for much of my life. Whether or not it was real, I imagined it, you know. And so as I've gotten older, I've grown to become more confident that those are never going to be issues with me.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this too shall pass. That's one of the things that I learned to embrace in the last 10 years, right? That no matter how bad something is, it will pass. It'll be fine. It won't be, for the most part, it won't be life threatening. It might be a little bit life changing, but and with that recognition, I'm able to find more pleasure, more joy, moment to moment. And my wife will say, and we've been together 35 years, she'll say I'm the happiest now that I've ever been.
Yeah, I reflect that. And knowing you the little that I do, but to get and to observe you and connect with you over the last, whatever it's been, 6 years or something.
Yeah.
I remember last time we recorded a conversation at your house, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago or something. And it was... I don't remember what you said exactly, but it was something along the lines of like, you've been in like a low level kind of like fight flight, kind of keep pushing the rock up the hill type orientation for a very long time. You don't seem like you're in that orientation presently. Like you seem like there is like a distinct like lightness to you presently.
Thank you. I'm, you know, it, and
like you're like celebrating. You're like, this is extra credit, guys. Like I'm
no, pretty much, pretty much. you know, 6 or 7 years ago, I was probably in the thick of Primal Kitchen, getting that started and, you know, had a lot of those typical headaches and stresses that a founder experiences. You know, I sold Primal Kitchen and, tried to be retired. That didn't work. So I had to go into another business, which I'm very happy.
Paluva.
Yeah. Paluva. So I, with my son, who's my co-founder, we started a brand new shoe company, a footwear company that's reimagining minimalist footwear. Mm. And I've got some on right now. So the difference between maybe 6 or 7 years ago and now is I don't have the pressure to succeed that I put on myself. I'm going to succeed. I mean, I have that goal and you know, I'm headed in that direction, but the pressure isn't as great as it was with Primal Kitchen. Mm. So that allows me a little bit more leeway to, you know, have fun along the way and enjoy the process. And whenever there's a, and it's also a teaching moment for my son who, you know, this is his first real big business experience and he's running the company basically. And so when we hit an impasse, which we have. The company's been in existence for 2.5 years. We've been doing R&D. We've been working through COVID out of manufacturing in China that was shut down for months at a time. We've had all sorts of issues, which, you know, in the old days, I would have just stayed up all night worrying about. And now I'm like, you know, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. We'll get through it. It'll be fine.
When you were going through the time frame of stress, would you have arrived to the same place of success or wherever it is that you arrived, this place that you're at now, without the added baggage of the stress? Was the stress supportive?
No, the stress, I think at the time, the stress was supportive.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword because the stress does prompt action, right? But sometimes stress can be debilitating, and you can be, you know, paralysis by analysis. You can overthink a problem and then get yourself into a deeper situation. Yeah. So stress can be, it can work both ways. And in the case of Primal Kitchen, I think it worked well. I think with Primal Kitchen, look, I put together an amazing team. So I think it was a combination of my having spent 10 years building a platform with Mark's Daily Apple so that when I introduced this new product, I had an audience ready, willing, and able to accept it because it was very different. I put together an amazing team. Morgan Bueller, who is now Morgan Zanotti, she got married while we were in the business, and she continues to run Primal Kitchen. She was instrumental in hiring a team of amazing people who are still with the company. Timing is huge in that. If we'd started that company 10 years earlier, it likely would not have succeeded, maybe because the world wasn't ready for a healthy for you, better for you, fat-based condiment line. It was based on avocado oil.
Yeah.
So timing plays a huge role in business and business success. So, you know, yeah, the stress is contributory, but there are so many other factors that it's just, you know, one factor in a list of 15.
My feeling is that stress is probably the longest lever towards tearing down one's physiology. Excessive stress,
yeah,
like chronic excessive stress.
I would agree. And you know, where you see this in acute stress is, you know, everybody's doing cold plunges right now. And and as an example, that's a great example of a hormetic stress, an acute, short-lived, short-term stressor that's supposed to be good for you. Well, now I see people going, you know, I did 4 minutes at 38 degrees,
yeah, right,
and now I'm doing 7 minutes. And at some point, I'm like, all right, now you've gone from it being a good stress to now it's being a bad stress. Now it's going to accumulate. Now it's going to, hinder your immune system. It's going to have some effect on you that's not good. And I know that because I've done that myself. I started doing cold plunging years ago, and I would get to the point where, same thing, I would do 4 minutes and it was just right. And then somebody would come up and say, hey, Mark, how long did you spend today? I'm like, 4 minutes. I did seven. I'm like, yeah, fuck it, I got to go do 11 now or so, and then I'd get sick. I'm like, so that's a, you know, sort of one example of how stress can go from good and very beneficial to bad, just based on the exposure to it and the length of time. So if you take that in a business situation or even in a family situation, a relationship situation where you feel like you're under stress all the time, it's not good, and it'll cause, you know, heart disease. It'll cause insulin resistance. It'll cause weight gain. It'll cause thyroid issues. It'll cause all manner of problems that don't need to happen if you knew how to deal with that particular stress.
How does a person deal with chronic stress from your perspective?
Oh, I mean, if I had the answer to that, if I could deliver that in the next paragraph, I'd be the first trillionaire. You know, stress pain is the number one complaint that people have, you know, around the world, but stress is probably the number one reason for prescription medications. It's probably the largest dollar volume producer of prescription meds in the world, these anti-anxiety, anti-anxiolytic, anti-stress meds. How do you deal with stress? I mean, it has to come from first the recognition that this, in most cases, the stress does not exist anywhere else except in your mind. So if you can come to terms with that and accept that, you can be a lot more resilient and ready, willing, and able to move on from this artificially made up thought pattern that you have, which is manifesting itself in the generation of neurotransmitters and stress chemicals that are in fact tearing you down. It's bizarre. My wife has done some work in the general term is spiritual psychology. That sounds a little too airy-fairy, but some form of psychology. And I was going through a really tough time, probably around the time we spoke last. And that might have been the restaurant experience that I was having. I had started a restaurant that was failing miserably. And I knew I was going to lose a lot of money on it. And it kept me awake at night, and it was horrible. And at some point, my wife said, look, I know you're losing sleep. You're staying awake, thinking thoughts all night. There's nothing you can do about it. So try this exercise. Lie on your side and take all those thoughts and envision them draining out of your brain through your ear onto your pillow and go to sleep. So simple little things like that can help. But, you know, it's a, you know, the stress question is a huge, huge question in a lot of people's life.
If a person, so for you, how did you begin to gain a relationship with your mind enough to have that agency with or over the thoughts?
Oh, it's still happening. It's an evolution, right? So, but once you get the experience of recognizing that it's just a thought and understanding that there's, in the case of what I was going through, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, there's nothing I can do about it. So it's not like my thinking about it is going to fix the problem. And if I were going to fix the problem, maybe I should get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and fix the problem. Well, that's not going to happen. So this understanding, this recognition that those sorts of thoughts are fruitless and useless and only serve to increase the stress levels, just the recognition of that allows you the room to let go of the thought. It doesn't mean the thought's not going to come back, but it's, you know, in sort of a similar to meditation where, you know, thoughts come and thoughts go. And if you can, you know, get a handle on those thoughts and start to recognize, you know, when the mind is chattering and quiet it down, it's the experience of doing that that gives you skill at doing that more efficiently and more effectively into the future. So it doesn't mean that you're not going to be subject to stress or stressful thoughts. It just means that rather than subject yourself to 2 weeks of stressful thinking or two days, maybe it's 2 hours or 10 minutes. So you still have the thought, you still have the reaction to it, you still have the visceral response, but the recognition that it's just a thought and that on my choice, I can dissipate that thought and have it go away. That's a pretty powerful tool. And nobody I know doesn't have stressful thoughts. It's just how they manage them over time.
The suggestion I've heard is as we age, stress can start to decrease. Where are you at in your, like, I think it's such a rare, amazing opportunity to communicate with someone that is 70 years old, mm-hmm. and is like, has this exuberant childlike.
You say that like it's old, Aaron. Jesus Christ. I mean,
no, the linear age, yeah, in our culture, yeah, is perceived as quote unquote old.
Oh, when I was your age, 70 was dead. So I'm with you.
Well, when I was when I was 15, the concept of being 35 was dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so like I'm not with the linear, yeah, yeah, suggestion. But culturally speaking, in the pot that we exist in, 70 is old.
Yeah. Yeah.
In your experience, you know, like your beingness is you're just you. You're, yeah, always just you.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
And so within you, oh, I had another question, but then I got wrapped up in that. Something that's interesting about you is you seem to keep moving. Like, it seems like that's been baked into your operating system for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that is, when a person gets stressed, like literally physiologically, what's happening is your body is preparing you to move. It's juicing up with all the epinephrine and norepinephrine and cortisol, and it's shunting blood from your viscera out to your legs and your arms to like get you out the door. For the most part, culturally, what we do with our stress is we bury ourselves into our cell phone, mm-hmm. you know, or under a computer, or mm-hmm. we'll watch Netflix and just kind of like fizzle in the stress hormones.
Curl up in a fetal position. And
It seems like something else that you've done, it just through happenstance or intentionally or both, is you've kept moving through the stress of your life.
Well, I mean, I think literally and figuratively. So literally, whenever I've felt that sort of thing, I get up and walk, or I get up and paddle, or I get up and ride a bike, or I do something that's a physical shift in blood flow and things like that. That's the literal manifestation of that moving. The figurative one is I'm always involved in something. I'm, you know, I feel compelled. People talk in business about, you know, you got to find your purpose and your passion, and you got to, you know, and you follow those and you'll be wealthy beyond all imagination. And I'm like, nah, it's, you know, if everyone was passionate about their job, we'd all own ice cream shops, because at 12 years old, I was passionate about ice cream and I loved it and I wanted to have an ice cream shop. No, it's, I'm compelled. I feel this inner urge to share the secrets that I've uncovered with the world, with other people. So whether that was, you know, my supplement company in the early mid 90s, when I started Primal Nutrition, I was creating products, formulations that athletes could use to enhance their recovery without falling under the performance enhancing drug moniker that the IOC was sort of looking out for. So I was compelled to create these formulas that people could use to improve recovery, because recovery is the biggest issue for elite athletes. You know, you can train all day. Training is easy for the most part. It's recovering and allowing yourself to recover and the right nutrition that's the difficult part of that equation. I was compelled to share that with the world. When I gave up grains in my 40s and realized that my IBS didn't have to be running my life, which it had for the prior 30 years, when I gave up grains and I had this miraculous recovery, I'm like, Jesus, if this is me, how many tens of millions of people need to hear this? I was compelled to share that with the world. So my idea of moving figuratively is moving into areas of, I mean, I suppose you could call it art and creativity. That's my form of art, is uncovering new secrets. You know, the Primal Blueprint was uncovering these hidden genetic switches that we all have, and then allowing the world to see that you can turn on genes that burn fat, and you can turn off the genes that store fat, and you could turn off the genes that cause inflammation, and you can improve your immune system by spending time in the sun, and all these genetic secrets that we have. My movement was, I felt compelled to get this out there, rather than sit there and just go, oh, I have this amazing information, it's going to work for me, so I don't care if anybody else finds out about it, because really it only affects me, and you know, it's my thing. Sorry, does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. Talking about?
So I'm always sort of moving in the direction of...
There's lots of versions of movement.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's fight or flight, right? And I fight. The third part of that is freeze. Yeah.
Which is what we're kind of doing when we're in our cell phones,
correct,
or our computers.
Correct. And so that's that catatonic, like, no action is better than any action. And I just don't... It doesn't resonate with me. Yeah.
I want to take a moment and share the morning ritual that I've stuck with for the last year. That is crawling out of bed, walking to the kitchen, and pouring myself a glass of AG1. I learned about this originally from Dr. Andrew Huberman. He's been drinking this stuff for the last decade or so, and I am also a massive fan of the product. Why I like it is it blends several different supplements that I would take anyway. So it is a probiotic and prebiotic, as well as a multivitamin and also a mineral supplement. It is the highest sourced ingredients. It tastes absolutely delicious. I notice a measurable change in my energy and my mood, and it is a gratifying sensation to know that I'm starting the day by covering my micronutrient baselines. So if you want to take ownership of your health, today is a great time to start. Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D, as well as 5 free travel packs with your first
purchase. To get this, all you got to do is go to athleticgreens.com/align. That's athleticgreens.com/align. I'm incredibly confident you guys are going to love this stuff. Go check it out, athleticgreens.com/align.
The reason I'll stop referencing the 70 years old thing in a second.
It's
but
fine.
The reason I was just talking to, I had a conversation with Stephen Kotler, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about certain psychological like patterns or dispositions manifesting themselves at each decade. And like one of the things he said, like by 50, if you don't figure out forgiveness by 50, where you're not blaming anybody,
yeah,
and you're actually truly in a place of sovereignty and agency and yeah, responsibility of like, I don't have the energy to hold on to resentment anymore.
Yep.
You know, there were certain landmarks of sorts that he had. And it's like, if you don't hit that, there's going to be problems.
Yeah.
And eventually in entering into like one's 50s and 60s, and he didn't mention 70s so much, but it's like this new element of like wisdom, mm-hmm, comes on, mm-hmm, creativity and these different aspects. Have you noticed, and this is the last that I'll ask about that, I'm so intrigued. You know, like, have you noticed any shift entering into 60s and now 70s of like, oh, like I feel different? Or have you always just been Mark?
Yeah, I feel like I've always just been Mark, and I feel that that I haven't changed a lot. What I have is grown more accepting of certain things in life. So the forgiveness thing is a great example. I'm much more forgiving of what I would perceive as other people's transgressions. Mm-hmm. And that comes back to also whatever event happens in that sort of context, it's my impression of the event that matters to me. It's my thoughts about the event that are causing my unease and my anxiety and my stress. Yeah. You know, the classic road rage incident where, you know, two people might get into a situation on the road where one of them cuts the other one off, and one person for the next 3 days is pissed off and angry, and the other one doesn't even know what happened and didn't cause it, didn't intend to cause it, didn't, you know, or maybe caused it but didn't intend to cause it, didn't see it happen, and has no idea that this other of the dis-ease, the unease that this other person's going through. But the other person's only going through that because of the thoughts about it, and the, not that there's a fix for that, but it may be, the reality may be that the person who caused it was just having a bad day and just, you know, wasn't even, you know, maliciously doing anything inappropriate in their mind, was just sort of distracted for a second. But then for someone else to go, if I found that person, I would, you know, I'd key their car, I'd, you know, whatever. And so much of that happens in life where you're unwilling to recognize that your own perceptions of an event are what's, they only matter to you. They don't matter to other people.
Yeah. I think it's Vietnamese language, there's no subjunctive form of grammar. So there's no, I would have.
Yeah.
Oh man, if I was here, I would have, you know, all of that.
Right.
Whereas us as English speakers,
right,
we can would have ourselves all day.
Right.
We can live in these fantasized stories of just like meaninglessness.
Right.
Just like there's nothing there.
I forget the comedian who he says, you know, he's talking about contractions and whoever invented contraction. He talks about would have, could have, and should have, the holy trinity of regret.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the only reason you ever use those is sort of in the context of regret.
And if your energy is there, then it's not somewhere else.
Right.
And so you'll just spin your tires in that place.
Right.
So in relation to movement, it seems like what I hear in the healthcare spaces, particularly the nutritional space, seems like exercise space is a little less dogmatic-ish, maybe ideological than the nutrition. Not completely. There's a lot of like ideology within it. But I personally hear a lot of minutia and a lot of noise and a lot of like tribalism, and typically the arc is someone comes back to simplicity and they come back to like, oh, okay, the same thing that we've been saying for the last 10,000 years, 5,000 years, 2,000 years, 500 years. There's like these consistent trends that comes back, and it's like, we probably need to spend more time in nature, we probably should get a little more sunlight, we probably should have better relationships, we should probably enjoy what we're doing, we should probably eat food that's close to the ground.
You think? You think?
And a part of that is foot health.
Yeah,
foot health. And so you created a company that is supportive for bringing us back to our more natural state from a
right.
Could I say pedological?
Sure.
Lens?
That's for sure. Why not? You made up a word. I'll use it.
I like that.
Yeah. No, you know, the same way that modern society has sort of unwillingly conspired to mess up our health with manufactured food mm-hmm. and the standard American diet, I think footwear has conspired to mess up this amazing organ that we carry around, that we depend on to move through space.
Yeah.
By
shoes too complex.
They're still basically giant bricks that we put on our feet. Look, we evolved for millions of years with bare feet for a reason, to be able to feel every footfall, every step, and to inform the brain of where we are in space. And with that information, by the time you put a foot forward and you start to load that foot, the brain already knows how to bend the ankle, how to flex the knee, how to torque the hip, how to compress or decompress muscles. It knows which way to rotate the ankle in case there's a thorn on one side and not the other. All of that information is important information for maintaining the biomechanics of the body. You know, the kinetic chain, the posterior chain, all starts with your contact with the ground.
Yeah.
And here we come along, starting 1,000 years ago, but certainly in the last 200 years, with these narrow, pointy, hard bottom shoes, at least in terms of dress shoes, or these ultra cushioned Bosu balls that we walk around on all day in these maximalist shoes, which bypasses all of that important sensory input and makes it sort of as if we're plodding along, lugging these bricks along with us, asking only of the ankle and up to do any kind of work. Well, imagine if you were a concert pianist and somebody said, I want you to play a Rachmaninoff piece, here's the sheet music, but now put on these oven mitts and play. And that's what we're doing with our feet. So feet are critical to proprioception, which basically defines like our knowledge of where we are in space and time relative to the earth. And how that's important is, you know, balance. Like, we're bipedal. Like, how do we even do this? We're standing on 2 feet and we don't fall over every few minutes, right? We need that information. And to have created so many different lines of shoes and footwear that bypass that information. Anyway, so along comes the minimalist shoe movement in the early 2000s. And it kind of took off for a while. It was very interesting. And there was a five-toed shoe that came out, and there was a number of companies made wide toe box shoes, and people started to sort of understand the concept of wide, thin, flat, flexible. So a wide toe box, a thin sole so you could feel the ground underneath, flat so that there was no drop from heel to toe, and flexible so that the shoe would roll with the change in terrain, and it would allow your foot to adjust and the small muscles of your feet to become stronger for having walked in these minimalist shoes. It took off McDougal's book, Chris McDougal's book, Born to Run, people started, wow, that's great. I'd run barefoot, but there's too much concrete and nails and glass and dog shit. So I'll wear these minimalist shoes. Well, one of the problems was that the minimalist shoes that came out were too minimal. We did evolve to walk barefoot, but we evolved to walk barefoot on matted grass, on hard packed dirt, on sand, on roots and trees, but not on concrete pavement, marble, tile, hardwood floors all day long, day in and day out. So our feet are not genetically adapted to walking on those sorts of hard surfaces. So you do need a little bit of padding. The question is how much. And so we said, well, let's design a shoe that gives you the effect of walking barefoot on a putting green. And that's sort of what dictated the design of the Puluva shoes. So we have a line of shoes. They're five-toed shoes. They are five-toed because you need to articulate the toes. The toes need to work up and down as well as splaying side to side. And with that up and down movement, you're able to, again, push off the big toe, which is important part of the kinetic chain, and the fact that we encase our feet together in other shoes kind of bypasses and obviates that need for the big toe to become much more involved in the push-off. Mm. These are they look like real shoes and not like, you know, ballet slippers for 200-pound guys. They are so we wanted to kind of blend the best elements of minimalist footwear and five-toed shoes with a good-looking upper. So our three criteria are comfortable. Number one, they have to be, and these are the most comfortable shoes I've ever worn. That was my number one design criteria. Number two, functional. They have to allow the feet to do what feet do. Our motto is let feet be feet. Yeah. And then they have to be stylish. And we have, I've got some styles
here. I like the white ones a lot. I'm about it.
Thank you.
Here for it.
Yes, this is sort of a casual shoe. It's a loafer. Slip-on, as people would say. It looks thick, right? It looks like it's got a thick sole. Like, how is that even a minimalist shoe? It's still only a little bit more than a centimeter off the ground. This is a fake sidewall to make it look stylish, like a regular shoe.
Right.
We have this in black and white. This is a leather, Napa leather upper, lace up. You could wear it to work. It's appropriate for weddings and funerals. And so you won't be, you know, shunted aside as that wacko that showed up with the five-toed shoes.
So something that I think is interesting with you, you're not at a point in your life where you need money. And I think you're in a point where like integrity and actually spreading wisdom. Probably in that epoch of your life.
Yes.
Like, okay, what can I leave with the world?
Yes.
And the fact that foot health is something that you feel strongly enough that you want to devote your energy to creating a company, right? I think is very interesting and meaningful. And I think it's very accurate
as
well. Where did that interest in foot health stem for you? And like, why do you feel it is so important? I mean, I know you just described, but like, is there some kind of origin of like,
well, I started, as a runner in my teens and I ran 40, 50 miles a week, first of all, in Chuck Taylor's. You know, basically Converse tennis shoes, sneakers, as we call them. There were no running shoes in those days. This is the late 60s, early 70s. And then I ran in Tiger Onitsuka, which was Phil Knight's first, before Nike existed, he got the rights to do this Japanese running shoe in the country. And so a lot of runners would run in these, what they called them, flats. And they were flat. They were very thin, flat-soled, zero drop, almost no cushioning. And what you understood was that your mileage was dictated by how your feet felt. In other words, it was your feet that told you when to stop running, not your knees, not your lower back, not your hip, not your heart, not your lungs. I mean, could go into a whole diatribe about chronic cardio and the fact that when Nike came along and started allowing people to run 100-mile weeks and 150-mile weeks, it not only bypassed all of that important sensory input in the feet, but you were able to do so much more work than you should have done that we now have a generation of people my age who have heart issues from having run too much. Hmm. And I'm one of them. I have PVCs. I have a compromised heart. I have my heart skips a beat every third beat when I get above 90 beats a minute, unless I take certain drugs for it. That's a result of my running too much. Because the running shoe companies allowed everybody to put in so many more miles when it's your feet who should have said, whoa, 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 50 miles a week,
right?
That's enough.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going to compete at an elite event and you're going to run world records and compete in the Olympics, then you automatically enter that realm knowing that you're going to compromise your health. There is no such thing as a really fully healthy elite athlete. You really have to compromise your health in order to get to the highest level in sports. So back to like what started me off on this was when I recognized that I was getting knee problems now, and I was getting all sorts of issues from running so many miles because I had these cushioned shoes that bypassed all of that important information and caused my knees to get wobbly and wonky and get chondromalacia because the information that I should have been getting from my feet about how to land was just being negated by the shoes that I was wearing. And as you'll see in the history of running shoe industry, there've been no decrease in running injuries. It's just the mileage goes up and the number of injuries stays the same.
Highest probability of sustaining an injury is through running.
Correct.
It's the most dangerous sport.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Ironically.
Yeah. So that's what got me started on it. And then, you know, I stopped running those miles, and thank God I did. But I got more and more interested in, as I was researching the Primal Blueprint and my book on ancestral traditions, and I realized, wow, we should be a complete being that starts from the ground up. So our movement starts with our connection to the ground, the kinetic chains, that the fascia and how it interlaces across the body. All of this needs the input of the feet to be optimized. Yeah, you can get away with wearing cushioned shoes. You can get away. Women get away with wearing high heels all the time. Man, it looks fabulous, but it's messing their feet up. Yeah. It's shortening the calf, the soleus, the gastroc, which puts pressure on the Achilles or the plantar fascia. Most women I know get some sort of form of bunion because you're taking the big toe, which is, if I use my thumb as an example, the big toe should be abducting outward. You should be able to spread your toes out, but all shoes kind of force that in and cause that abduction part of us to not only atrophy, but it also restricts blood flow and can cause issues further up the foot, whether it's plantar fasciitis. Yeah. And so the idea that you could, that there's a, like the reason people are wearing toe spreaders now, these things that you put between your toes, these silicone toe spreaders, it's all the rage among the women now. Yeah. Well, our shoes do that all day long. Yeah. Now, people say, well, but what about running, Mark? Well, we say don't run in our shoes. Walk in our shoes. Spend the whole day, go to the gym in our shoes, ride a bike, walk, do stair climbing, do battle ropes, do all your Olympic lifts, do everything you would do. Go to work. If you're a clerk, stand on your feet all day in our shoes and spread your toes out and get that feeling of toe freedom and work the small muscles of your feet. Then when it's time to do your sport, put on your appropriate shoes, right? If you have running shoes that you like, put those on. If you have cleats for playing soccer, I mean, certainly one day there will be wide toe box cleats for soccer. There'll be wide toe box cleats for basketball players. I mean, if you've seen pictures of LeBron James' feet, it's horrible. Like how he can even stand is beyond me, and it's because it's encased in these casts. Yeah. You know,
and he's had huge feet. That's a situation for a lot of basketball players as well. They're like this 7 foot,
correct,
huge person with size 16 feet. It's like, oh God.
Well,
and they probably grew up with not a lot of money as well. So it's
it doesn't, you know, so right, the experience of wearing ill-fitting shoes, shall we say, your entire life takes a toll on you over time.
Yeah.
So we decided we would make a shoe for all occasions. So one of our things is a Palooza for all occasions. So we make shoes to work out in, to go hiking in, to go to work in and hang out all day, go out to dinner in. I mean, I have shoes that I wear. I go to some of the fanciest restaurants in Miami wearing one of the shoes is called the Miami. One of the styles, or the leather lace-ups, and they're the most comfortable shoe I've ever worn. I can spend, you know, the whole evening wearing them. And if I didn't want you to notice that there were 5 toes to my shoes, you wouldn't even notice.
Yeah. I think that the thing, like one of the things that you and I think you and Rob Wolf kind of pioneered the concept of metabolic flexibility.
Yes.
Is that right? Was that a word before you guys? There's some scientists that came up that first? Or how's that go?
Maybe, but if you look at the literature, I kind of wrote about it first. Rob kind of talked about it the same time I did as this catch-all phrase for a description of the body's, you know, ability to optimize energy substrates. Yeah.
Well, I think you could also have, I'm pioneering a new word as of right now, kinesthetic flexibility.
Yeah.
And so within that, if you are doing the proper, taking your feet in this example, your body as a whole through just general standard full functional ranges of motion with some level of regularity.
Right.
It opens up the availability to wear high heels or to wear bowling shoes or to wear business pointed shoes. Like it doesn't actually matter. What matters is that each day or week, you have some amount of time that you're investing in taking yourself through these full functional ranges of motion. So you can create that neurological connection.
Correct.
You can actually connect those, that aspect, like map your foot in the brain.
Right.
What people don't realize is your, well, maybe people listening to this largely realize, but you know, your feet are very much like your hands, and they're responsible for over a quarter of the bones in your whole entire body. So we have 406 bones. I think they're probably various from person to person. There's 26 bones in each foot. So that's 52. It's like more than a quarter.
Yep.
Probably evolution or God or whatever intended some level of dexterity with our feet. If it granted a quarter of the bones to just that unit down there. And there's 33 joints. There's a lot of articulation and function in there.
And, you know, 77% of people complain about foot pain at some point in their life. That's not right. Why, like, we're a modern civilization. We should be getting rid of pain, not increasing the amount of pain.
And then 80% of people experience back pain, and the feet share neural pathways with the lower back.
The number of people who have back pain who could be corrected by just appropriate walking.
As well as knee pain. So the knee ends up being kind of like the whippy boy for what's happening with the hip or with the foot. And what's happening with the hip is associated with the foot and vice versa.
Right.
So it's not just a foot thing. It's but the foot is, there's going to be a trickle up effect from whatever's happening down there. So you need to start with the feet.
Absolutely.
And then also address what's happening with the hip and what's happening with the midsection, what's happening with the whole thing. And to have that kinesthetic, hashtag kinesthetic flexibility, my new term.
Right now it's happening.
I think you can get away with eating a lot of shit or moving in a lot of seemingly shit ways, just so long as you're incorporating some of these health inducing ranges of motion.
Correct. So we're not going to say, look, you know, if you wear Paluvas, you'll fix everything that ails you. I don't want to say that. I can't say that. It's a claim that I'm not willing to make. What I am going to say is I will argue that they're the most comfortable shoe you've ever worn. They are better for your feet because they allow your feet, your toes to articulate. You want to feel the ground underneath. I hiked in some of the most inhospitable terrain in these, a version of these. Last summer, I put 650 miles on pavement, on concrete, and hiking in rocky terrain. And every footfall was like, oh my God, it's like a massage. It feels great. Like every time my foot twisted, I appreciated it for what it was and what it was helping my body adjust to. Now I'm doing these hikes on trails with people wearing thick, stiff hiking boots. And I'm like what happens if you step sideways on a slanted rock, you know, and your feet aren't strong enough to withstand that? That's where people twist ankles, and because they haven't built up the small muscles of their feet. B, you know, the shoe is acting like a lever to enhance the amount of torque that's put on a missed step. Whereas with these, every time I step, I know exactly how to weight the foot. I know exactly, it's a real cool sensation that I only ever got from one other shoe, but that shoe was just too thin. And so I would feel the...
Yeah, when they're too thin, they're impossible to run. I find I'd rather be barefoot than run in a minimalist shoe that's like super thin.
Right.
I think when you're wearing a shoe, it gives you this sensation of feedback, like you're wearing a shoe.
Yeah.
But it's actually just like a very thin piece of nothingness.
Correct.
And so then you run maybe a little sloppier than you would.
Yep.
And I personally find it very challenging. Another just analogy in relation to the foot, if people are interested in kind of having some kind of visual experience with what their feet could be, and if you look at your wrist and you go through that articulation of flexion extension and, you know, the flexion extensor of the wrist, you can see that articulation up through the forearm. You can feel it, like that movement, that mirrors what's happening within the foot.
Yep.
But because we've been in these like foot coffins, essentially, where we're atrophying, inhibiting the potential range of motion within the feet, that starts to, you know, we lose our mapping of that. It starts to kind of become like a club. And then that inevitably will trickle up into the relationship of our over athleticism and, you know, knee pain, hip pain, and things of the sort. So just taking the foot through and just give it like a little massage, like get curious, take your shoes off, you know, start working with that abduction, like you mentioned with the big toes, like having the toes kind of spread towards each other, is a very big deal.
Yep.
It trickles up into the rest of the system.
One of the things that we notice with first time users of the Paluva is the time it takes to get the shoe on the first time, to get each toe into its individual toe box.
Yeah.
And I find it somewhat humorous, but it's also indicative of a fact that if you can't do that, it's probably an indication that you need a shoe like this to spread your toes out. And what we do notice is that after the third or fourth or fifth time of wearing the shoes, they slide right in, and now you're starting to develop that articulation and that toe splay, which is so important to every aspect of foot health. People say, well, how come there's no arch support in your shoe? Isn't it like I have weak arches and I need an arch support? I need an orthotic. Well, the irony there is nobody's born with weak feet and weak arches. You're born with a perfect set of foot muscles that will develop an arch if you go barefoot enough and you articulate and you use the toes and everything else. Walk on varied surfaces. But, you know, we put cute little shoes on the kids and we encase their feet so early that over time, the arch says, I don't need to work. I mean, I'm being supported by this piece of shoe that is unburdening me of having to do any work. And so people really don't have bad arches. Well, they do, but it's not a genetic issue. It's a training issue, right? And so we would say build the arch by walking around in barefoot if you can. Ideally, always barefoot, but be realistic, right? Again, the surfaces we talked about, the hard surfaces make it almost impossible. So if you have palluvas, you can walk around as if you're barefoot, feeling the surface underneath. I mean, I look for, even on sidewalks, I look for little bolts sticking up out of the ground
to walk
over. It's crazy. And I think most of our ancestors probably had that same sort of sensation, like this is what it's supposed to be. You're supposed to be feeling everything underneath your feet when you walk, not completely bypassing it with a thick, rigid sole that offers no additional information.
I want to take a moment and share a free resource with y'all to sort out your movement. That is starting the first free week of the Align Method online program, where you get a thorough movement assessment to establish what is your personal movement baseline. And then on top of that, we share fundamental mobility techniques that will make a massive difference in your own personal practice. If you do any type of stretching or yoga or foam rolling or resistance band training or training in general, you want to get the most out of your body. These are must-know mobility techniques. And then it finishes with a sit rise challenge, so you can test yourself and see how effectively you get up and down off of the ground. That is the first week of the Align Method online program. It's a 6-week program. You can start the first week at alignpodcast.com/AMP. And with that, you will also join the free Align community, where there's over 3,000 other members in there. So I pop in there each day, totally free. The first week is totally free. And then if you don't love the idea of continuing on with the 6-week program, then you can cancel anytime. So check us out over at alignpodcast.com/AMP.
Yeah. And it activates your sensitization to reality, which might be getting a little metaphysical. But if we live in a world where we're just continually looking at the same banal image over and over again, everything's two-dimensional, we're in this, you know, inside of a box, and then we go into our box car, like Tony Robbins says, go in your box office and your box car, and then your box, you know, and then you have a cylinder in the form of a beer to like decompress from the day.
Right.
But we're in this very redundant box reality. And that's kind of been desensitized.
Yes.
And if you've ever been in a relationship that's really coming to a close, it's probably coming to a place where it's not very sensitized anymore. It's kind of like, okay, like,
yep,
there's nothing here.
Yep.
We're good.
Yep.
You know, it's like, let's move on.
Yep.
And a person that's depressed is probably not a person that's like passionately angry about a thing. Mm-hmm. They have this banal gray, just like, what is the point?
Yeah, no, I would say, you know, they say, what is the opposite of hate? It's or what's the opposite of love?
Yeah,
it's indifference.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not hate. It's indifference.
Yeah, if you're indifferent, and so there's we have this kinesthetic indifference that's transpiring as well.
Right.
So opportunities to become excited about like these colors in the room, or like the temperature on my skin, or the sensation on my feet. That I would suggest in my, you know, my perspective, that's would combat also things like anxiety and depression, a lot of like the mental illness that society is going through.
Absolutely. So as a runner, I hated to walk. It was a waste. Walk is a waste of time. I spent my life running. So I would just, I mean, that's how I learned how to run. I lived 2 miles from school, and I could walk to school, but it took too long. So I'd run to and from school, and I'd beat the bus, and there was all sorts of economies of scale in my running. And that's how I learned how to run. So walking became a waste of time. Now, as I've gotten older, walking is one of my favorite things to do. I write a lot about it. It is who we are. We're bipedal. We should be walking. Yep. So I'm in Europe for 3 months last summer with all of these prototypes of the shoe, trying them out in different contexts. And what I noticed was I felt compelled to walk. I wanted to walk. I felt like every time I walked, I was getting a treat on my feet. Now, conversely, when I wore one of the most popular running shoes to hit the market in the last 5 years, it's gone off the charts in terms of popularity. They look great. I'd walk a mile or mile and a half and my knees would start to hurt. And parts of my body would start to hurt if I wore those to go out to dinner and walk a mile and a half to dinner. And it was not that way with the Puluvas because I was able to feel the ground underneath, and it was just enough cushioning that I could do a heel toe, a heel strike, and not get a bone bruise on my heel, because that's one of the issues with a truly minimalist shoe that's so hard. But I could also feel everything underneath and kind of in a massaging type way.
Can I ask you a couple more questions about
Go for it. Yeah.
Wisdom?
Yeah.
I'd like to learn about wisdom. So we live in a world where we're saturated in information.
Yeah.
And, knowledge.
Yeah.
Everybody has the answers to everything, except we're still overweight and we're still anxious and we're still depressed and we're still not making enough money and,
right,
all these things. But the information is there. How does a person, from your perspective, develop wisdom? Does that even make sense as a question?
It makes sense as a question, but it's a loaded question, because wisdom is a sense of confidence that the choices that you're making are appropriate in the context of all that you've learned. And so sometimes, wisdom, I'd like to think that it's an objective concept, but I think it's more of a subjective construct, wisdom. And there are so many places in so many topics of conversation and topics of news. Is global warming really happening, and is it going to be the end of us, or is it all just made up bullshit from whatever? And I can argue both sides of that. So where's the wisdom in the only wisdom is what are my choices for myself based on my experience that don't hurt anyone else and serve me, and that's kind of how I would. So what's the wisdom in, like, if I give you advice, it may or may not be wisdom. It may just be my perspective on something that served me well, but may not serve you. Is that wisdom? I'm not sure. So I think wisdom is, and this is the first time I've really thought about this, so you got to bear with me.
Yeah, let's workshop it.
Let's workshop it. Yeah. But I think wisdom is more of a personal, subjective construct that makes, for me anyway, makes me confident that the choices I'm making will serve me based on my life experience.
Do you think that you'll have any regrets when you go into transition out of the body phase at age 160?
No, at 160. Dude, I mean, here's one of the things. Like, I kept saying, I'm good if I make it to 90, and like, fuck, 90 is only 20 years away now. Holy shit.
Crazy,
like,
man. You know? That's different. Yeah. Your perception of the world would have to be so different than a 35-year-old.
No, it's very different. Yeah. Because I was totally immortal when I was 35.
Yeah, I think.
And now it's like, well, I might not live to see great-grandchildren. Speaking of Rob Wolf, we've been good friends for a long time, and I shared this with him early on in our experience. I said, you know what? I feel good about what I've done in my life. And every day when I get up in the morning and take a leak, I just sort of stare out the window and I go, you know what? If today's the day, I'm good. If today's the day they come to take me, I'm good with everything that's happened.
How does a person come to that point of being at ease with their own demise? I know we're getting a little heavy.
I mean, for me, it's like, I feel like I've made a contribution. So I feel like Anything I do from here is gravy, as you said, or profit.
Extra credit.
Extra credit, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. I'm gonna go for extra credit. I like points, you know. So I want extra points. But by the same token, if it happened that this was the last day, I would, you know, if I stepped outside of my shell and said, "What do you think?" I'm like, "Yeah, it's cool. I'm good with it."
Do you have the same neurotic patterns that you had when you were 35? Now they're just more manageable, or is there anything that's been actually made obsolete as far as like inconvenient neurotic patterns?
Again, that's a therapy question that I need to slouch down. I need to lie down with a pillow to answer that one. No, I think I have. I have the same neurotic patterns, and they're just more manageable, and they've never been debilitating in any stretch. Mm. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Aaron. I didn't expect this conversation, and I'm happy we had it because you know what? I've disseminated the metabolic flexibility talk so much over the years.
I'm so tired of nutrition.
Yeah, same.
Because I feel like it fluctuates so much. And so the things that we're hopped up about now, the only thing that's consistent is what's been said for, you know, decades and centuries and millennia.
Yep.
In my perspective, which what the hell do I know?
Yeah. No, it's true. It's cyclical. It always comes back.
And there's value in each, but it's just the overarching umbrella concept for, because something worked for me on my specific dietary, biological, whatever situation, suddenly this needs to be the overarching thing for every other person on the planet.
Correct.
Like, I think that if one can tap into the wisdom and the intuition of their body probably has a lot more information to share than they realize.
100%. That was the original N equals one, right? That we talked about literally from day one in paleo was all of this is a template, but it's really an experiment of one, and you have to work with your own. Yeah.
But if you're continually waiting for some double blind clinical study to come out to tell you like it's okay to take a piss in the morning.
Yeah.
It's like, bro.
Yeah.
Like pull back a little bit.
Yep. 100%.
All right. So people should, what would be a great invitation for people from
here? I'd love people to go to www.peluva.com, P-E-L-U-V-A.
Cool.
Peluva. And try those out. 30-day guarantee. I guarantee they'll be the most comfortable shoe you've ever put on. Otherwise, Mark's Daily Apple, always there, apparently always will be there. And thanks for having me, man. It was great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I really dig this. All right, that is it. That is all. Thank you all for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I want to thank you for subscribing and sharing this. If you do, you can tag myself at Align Podcast. You can tag Mark at Mark Sisson. And also, I want to invite you guys over to the Align Podcast YouTube channel, where we are posting instructional content each week on movement, exercises, mobility, self-care, and things of the like. Thank you all so much for tuning in. I will see you next week.